So welcome everybody to the June call. You know, it was interesting when I opened my paper this morning, the first thing that the paper reminded me was that this is June 6th and June 6th it was D-Day. And one of the things that some people might not be aware of about D-Day is that how important a particular climate scientist was to that. So before the invasion of Normandy, our generals went to Walter Monk, because Walter Monk could scientifically predict the tides, and we needed to know exactly where the tides would be so that invasion could be successful. And so Walter Monk did that. The question is, does CCL, Walter Monk was still alive last year. I think he's probably still alive now. Question is Walter Monk have a connection to CCL? And the answer is, of course Walter Monk has a connection to CCL. He and Danny actually had breakfast together at a conference at the Vatican last year, so I suspect that he knows something about what you're doing. And if some by chance, Dr. Monk, you're on the call today, thank you for the work that you did way back then. Okay, let me just check again. Danny, can you hear me or can we hear you?
I can hear you. Can you hear me now?
Okay, beautiful. I can hear you now. Okay, perfect. Okay, so before we get into Dr. Richter's talk, which I think is really, really important for us, which is how does the dividend impact different groups of people? I want to welcome the new groups to CCL and then just tell you a couple quick things that happened since last month's call. So first of all, Plattsburgh, New York, welcome. Howard County, Maryland. Conejo Valley, California. Asheville, North Carolina. Raritan Valley, New Jersey. Boise, Idaho. So great to have all of you aboard. Welcome, and great to have you part of CCL. Also, we added two new chapters in Australia, in Tangney and also in North Sydney. So congratulations and welcome to all of you. And then we added two new groups in Germany, one in Munich and the other in Berlin. And we had our first German conference. And in addition to having a German conference, we had our first lobby day, as they called themselves, the Burger Lobby of Stein in Berlin. So they had their first lobby day in Germany, which was fantastic. One of the parliamentarians that they met with actually asked them to go to dinner the night after lobby day in Germany, which was particularly important because he represents an area where there's a lot of lignite coal. And as Niels said, it was important for them to establish that the issue of climate and coal mining jobs doesn't mean you have to ignore the other party. So congratulations to everybody in Germany. So fantastic to have you all on board. I also want to mention two things that I thought were really interesting that happened in Texas last month. So there was a conference that we were invited to. Peter Brin, our Texas state coordinator, and also the group leader in Houston, who, by the way, is an employee of ExxonMobil, and I'm very proud of that. And Peter is an absolute rock star in this organization. And Ricky and I attended. This is Peter's thank you note back to the conference organizers after the event. He says, thank you very much for the invitation. It was an interesting experience for me in the morning at the first panel with Mark at CCL at one end of the stage and Pete from ExxonMobil at the other. It was sort of seeing my personal and professional world collide a bit. However, at one point when Pete, entirely unprompted and seemingly quite genuinely said, our friends at Citizens Climate Lobby have been in touch with him, it was a surprising and moving moment for me. I don't get moved by many things. I think it was a sort of validation of the type of respectful, engaging approaches like those exercised by CCL that really do work, even if they're slow at times. So, you know, that was a remarkable moment. And I certainly hope that all the statements that you see in the press these days of oil companies talking about the importance of a price on carbon, I hope we had something in some small way contributed to that. And I also want to say that, you know, we have a team called Team Oil and CCL that Peter Fukowski started and has been running, and he's in the process or, in fact, has turned it over to Liz Fisher. So I want to thank the two of you for taking such leadership on this issue, and congratulations to Peter and Ricky on the great event in Texas. I want to mention one other thing in Texas, though, and that is they have been really, really frustrated down there of not getting a response from Senator Ted Cruz to meet with us during the June conference. And so they have been collecting hundreds of cards that people are writing at tabling events. And what they've been telling the people who come to their table is, if you write a handwritten card to Senator Cruz, we'll deliver it to his office. And telling people that he'll deliver it seemed to give people extra motivation to write the cards. Now, all of you may not be aware that in D.C. we have a team called an envoy team that is happy to drop off notes to members of Congress or pieces of media. So our envoy has been stopping at Senator Cruz's office and developing a relationship in addition to our Texas people, our D.C. envoy with Cruz's office. The last time he dropped off cards, he saw the aide. The aide was appreciative of getting the cards and said, you know, I think we'll be able to see you guys in June. He reached out to Cruz's office to our liaison in Texas and actually scheduled the meeting for June. So really phenomenal work. Everybody in Texas who participated in that, I think that's just extraordinary work. Okay, then I also just want to mention that we had another REMI briefing, and once again, very much of a bipartisan issue. 56% were Democrats, 44% were Republicans. So that meant in this Senate briefing, a lot of people from both the Republican and Democratic side of the aisle were briefed. I also want to congratulate for anybody who contributed to our fundraising effort in the spring. We exceeded our fundraising goal for the spring, raised $214,000. So if anybody who contributed to that, thank you so much. Okay, I want to mention one last thing about tabling, and that is this. I've spent a fair amount of time tabling also. And, you know, there's a lot of good things that tabling does for us. It's allowed us to grow a lot of additional chapters. It's allowed us to expand the number of people who are in our existing chapter. It's allowed other people to contribute who maybe that's the only thing they're going to do. And certainly members of Congress tell us that they don't hear often enough from members of Parliament in Canada. They don't hear from the public. They don't hear from the people in their district enough. So giving people a chance to write is a really important part of that. I have one other answer to why do we always table. And my answer is Danny Richter. Because 7 years ago, we had a – this is before I joined CCL – we had a table at Balboa Park on Earth Day, and who walked up was Danny Richter. And what came out of that was Danny started the La Jolla chapter, which was about the third or fourth chapter in CCL at that point. And the chapter has been comprised almost entirely of PhD candidates or people who have their PhDs at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. So it's been a really important piece of the organization to have that incredible climate resource as part of the organization. It became obvious to us how really remarkable Danny's analytical skills were, and way before he finished his PhD, we have been sending him all kinds of pieces to analyze and give us back to us in a way that civilians could understand, oftentimes very technical data. And so we were waiting for quite some time for Danny to simply finish his PhD so that we could bring him on board. And, you know, to me, you know, of all those times when you sit tabling and you say, why am I doing this? The answer, Danny Richter, is always sufficient for me. So, Dr. Richter, great to have you on. I must say that I usually have a fair amount of stress that our speaker's not going to show up. I fret about that a lot on Fridays and Saturdays. I did not fret about that this time.
So glad.
Yeah, very good. You, removing stress from my life is a good thing you do. Okay, so we want to talk about the dividend. And just to get a little background before we get to the paper that you've been presenting members of Congress with, a lot of the data that we've had on the dividend comes from the Carbon Tax Center. So let's just, first of all, could we start a little bit on how did the Carbon Tax Center come up with their conclusions and so that we can just get a little background on that before we get to what we want to talk about today.
Sure. Well, CCL uses the Carbon Tax Center calculations for our estimate that about two-thirds of households end up ahead with our policy. And the Carbon Tax Center came to their conclusion on a spreadsheet that is available on their website, so their calculations and assumptions are public, and anyone in the world can review them and critique them or find them to be adequate. And what they did is the key assumption they make is that per household spending on fossil fuels is perfectly represented by household income. And when you make that assumption and you do some really very basic calculations, they find that a 100% dividend makes 65% of households whole. Now, the Carbon Tax Center will be the first ones to tell you that this is a quote-unquote rough and ready approximation, but it is nonetheless pretty much in line with previous results about the link between income and fossil fuel spending. And for example, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that in 2005, the highest earning quintile of Americans accounted for 32% of total gasoline spending, while the lowest quintile contributed just 9%. The middle quintile, true to its name, spent exactly 20% of the total. So that's a brief outline of how the Carbon Tax Center came to their conclusions.
Okay, so we've had other people who've talked about how the dividend would impact people. 2009, there was the CLEAR Act, or some people would call it the Cantwell-Collins bill. And what were the assumptions and how did they back that up of how they believed that would impact households?
Sure. Cantwell-Collins was a cap and dividend bill. So about the time that it was getting a lot of press, there was a study done on cap and dividend. It wasn't exactly one-to-one. The study, which came out of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, used an 80% dividend, whereas the CLEAR Act would have done a 75% dividend, so pretty close. By the way, if you want to see this study, it is reference 4 in the two-pager I wrote and which is linked to in the action sheet. And this study found that if 80% of the revenue were returned as dividends to the public, within each state, at least 60% of households receive net benefits. By contrast, if you plug 80% into the Carbon Tax Center rough and ready estimate spreadsheet, you get 55%. So the Carbon Tax Center estimate is actually lower than this other estimate. So we feel pretty good about this because even though it's rough and ready, it's giving us more conservative answers than this other more detailed study.
Okay, good. And then there's obviously some data in the REMI report about how the dividend impacts people, and can you just talk about that a little bit, and then we'll get to the new paper?
Sure. The REMI study doesn't address this question directly. Several people have asked Scott, and he said, nope, we don't do this. But it does address how average and low-income Americans end up with our policy. So if you look at figure 3.26, which is on numbered page 38 of the full REMI study available on our website, it reports real disposable personal income, or RDPI. And that's after inflation, after the increased costs, how wealthy is your average person? Or do they have more money or do they have less after our policy? What REMI found is that RDPI goes up in every single year of our policy. And the figure right above that, still on page 38, breaks this down region by region. And it shows that every region is ahead after 20 years except the West North Central, with the East North Central pretty much flat. But as they explain, this is a function of population. These two regions see the highest influx of people. And so you're spreading actually an increased amount of wealth over a proportionally larger increase in people. So you have more people, you have more wealth, but it ends up being about even. One thing that is notable is that the West-South Central, which is the one that the region that kind of stands out, they actually do end up ahead. So the average resident of the West-South Central, there is more money in that region with our policy than without. Another important graph in the REMI study is figure 3.22 on page 36. And this shows employment by quintile. And again, a quintile is 20% of the population. Now, the bottom three quintiles, the poorest 60% of Americans, see more job growth than the upper two, notably more. And it turns out that the poorest 20% after 20 years has pretty close to 2% increase in employment relative to if you don't do anything. But the upper two quintiles also do add jobs relative to the baseline. So you have a lot more jobs with the poorest Americans more likely to have those jobs than not. Mark, would you like me to go and talk about who did this study and why we should listen to them?
Yeah. So let me just say that, you know, usually we would have the author come on. He's in Austria. We didn't want to wait for him coming back. We thought this was timely. So if you would talk, just mention who the author is, a little bit of the author, the organization, and then talk about what the conclusions of this paper, which have been, you know, reviewed by really some top-notch people. Okay, go ahead, Danny.
Sure. So the author of the study is Kevin Umel, and he did it while he was at the Center for Global Development. But Kevin was recently recruited to be a research scholar at the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, or IIASA. And as Mark mentioned, this is in just outside Vienna, Austria. So that's why we couldn't have him on the call. His current institution, IIASA, conducts policy-oriented research into the problems of a global nature that are too large or too complex to be solved by a single country or academic discipline. And Mr. Rommel holds a Master's of Science in Environmental Science, Policy, and Management from a joint program at the University of Manchester and the Central European University, and he holds a BA in Public Policy from Stanford University. The institution he left, the Center for Global Development, conducts research and analysis on a wide range of topics related to how policies and actions of the rich and powerful affect poor people in the developing world. And examples include aid effectiveness, climate change, education, globalization, health, migration, and trade. And in case you're wondering why we should pay attention to this think tank, this year the Center for Global Development was ranked by the University of Pennsylvania as the number 4 international development think tank in the whole world, and the number 27 top think tank overall in the United States. So this is a pretty well-respected think tank that we're talking about here. And so what did they find in this study, and how does it relate to what we're doing? Well, what I found this study particularly useful for is there are three questions that we frequently get when we meet with members of Congress. And those three questions are, number one, won't people use the dividend to keep burning fossil fuels? Number two, will voters in my district end up ahead with carbon fee and dividend? And number three, how will rural voters fare? The answer to question number one, won't people use the dividend to keep burning fossil fuels, is found in figure one. This is the figure where you have, it's the bar chart where you have 7 multicolored bars. And for those colors, only red and orange are direct emissions. All the others are indirect. Now, most people, when they think about their emissions, only think about these direct emissions, and that is flipping on light switches and filling up the tank. But for the average American, the leftmost bar on this chart, direct emissions account for only 36% of our emissions. 64% of the average American's emissions, or almost two-thirds of our climate-relevant decisions, are indirect. So the answer to this question is people won't use the dividend to buy more fossil fuels with an upstream fee because the bulk of their emissions come from purchases they don't realize have emissions. Another thing about this, apparently there's a misconception. Our policy, when we talk about two-thirds of households ending up ahead, this is not just for their spending on electricity bills. It's not just for energy costs. This is for all their spending across the entire economy, and that's because of the upstream fee. Another thing I want you to notice about this bar chart is that income quintiles 1, 2, and 3, or 60% of the population, are all clearly below average. And if you average revenues from a carbon fee and give everything back to people equally, as we do in our policy, being below average means that you should give back more than you're spending in increased costs. So this figure is in line with the Carbon Tax Center's rough and ready estimate, and this is important because it helps us interpret the next figure that I want you to pay attention to. And this also helps us answer question two. Will voters in my district end up ahead with carbon fee and dividend? Now, if you were able to download the two-pager that I wrote in connection with this talk, and there was a link to this in your action sheet right below my bio, I believe. And the answer to two is if you look at the map, blue in this map is below average emissions. These are zip code by zip code. So zip codes where the average is below average emissions. White is average and red is above average emissions. And remember from the previous figure that income quintiles 1, 2, and 3 are all below average. Since CCL's policy averages national emissions and has an equal dividend, the average household should get back what they're paying in increased costs, should even out. Blue districts, being below average, should definitely end up ahead. White districts will break even, and red districts will be behind. Remember, not everyone in a zip code makes the same amount of money, so the average person in a blue district will end up ahead, but some will end up even and others will end up behind. Just keep that in mind when you're talking to your member of Congress. But you can briefly answer this question by showing your member of Congress this map and pointing to his district, his or her district, on this map. Now, the answer to question three about rural voters. Rural voters do tend to have higher emissions than urban dwellers. But these same rural voters tend to have lower emissions than suburban dwellers. Why is that? The answer is that suburbanites tend to have more money. And as we learned from Figure 1, if you have more money, you're able to buy more stuff, and most of our emissions are tied up in the stuff we buy. So if you have more money, you tend to buy more stuff. And since suburbanites tend to have more money, they just tend to buy more stuff. Location is not as important as income. This link being more important, income in carbon emissions is much more important than location in carbon emissions. This has been found by many studies, some of which I've mentioned and referenced in that two-pager. And this is also in line with the Bureau of Labor Statistics data that I mentioned earlier on gasoline spending. So in this map, again, Kevin used zip codes, which have population density associated with them. And this is why he was able to tease apart the distinction between urban, suburban, and rural Americans.
Great. And so, Danny, one specific question that came in was, why does North Dakota look like it's not doing that well, given that it's, you know, primary rural and not that big a state?
Sure. That's a great question. And we have to remember the lesson we just learned, and that is that income is more important than where you live. So while North Dakota is fairly rural, it only has 700,000 residents, it is in the midst of a fracking boom right now. And if you go ahead and you Google top 10 fracking jobs, you will find an article that reports the top 10 fracking jobs, not all of which require a bachelor's degree, pay between $100,000 and I think $240,000 a year. So North Dakota has a lot of very wealthy, well above the mean income for Americans, and they have pretty close to full employment. So I found another article talking about how even fast food workers will have been known to get a signing bonus because they're just there's so much money, there's so many people coming here that they don't have enough people to fill these jobs. So that's why North Dakota is in the red. It doesn't matter that it's rural. What matters is that people there are doing quite well right now.
Okay, good. So some of the conclusions we can draw from this is when we talk about who's made whole or not whole, we're not talking about just direct energy costs. We're talking about all of the economic decisions they make. And that actually for most people, what they buy has more of an impact on their carbon footprint than their use of energy.
That's correct, because all the goods and services we buy also have energy embedded in their life history. And this really underlines the importance of an upstream fee, because it's really only with an upstream fee that you get this whole economy effect, so that we can see the goods that have higher carbon embedded in them, they'll just become more expensive. We won't know why, but we're going to be less inclined to buy them. And by being less inclined to buy them, we're actually going to be making more climate-friendly spending decisions.
Right, and it also adds some elucidation to why, you know, overwhelmingly economists are in favor of a carbon fee or carbon taxes, because it drives decision-making throughout the entire economy.
That's also correct. And the other thing that is important about this is the dividend. It really does refund you for your overall costs, not just your costs on your energy bill, your gasoline. It's your overall costs.
Great. All right. Well, Dr. Richter, thank you so much. Appreciate you doing all the research on this. Just so if you could just give people one last sense, you've been presenting this to congressional offices on the Hill. How are people receiving this information?
I find that they're receiving it very well. I try not to make too much out of it because it is one study. But being able to point at their district on the map and being able to show them that really a minority of the average American's carbon emissions come from what they put in their tank or how many times they flip on the light switch, I found that to be very powerful. And it is very useful in dispelling some common misconceptions, both within Congress and in the general population. When I present it to members of Congress or their staff, it's eye-opening and it leads to great discussion.
Great. And then just one last thing I would say is our friend Shiling Su says the best economists in Washington, D.C. are Resources from the Future, and Dallas Bertraw, who I think is the top economist at RFF, was one of the people who reviewed the paper, so it's been looked at by some really top-notch people.
That's correct. Dr. Shiling Su is not the only one who thinks so highly of Dallas Bertraw, and Dallas actually had very positive things to say about this study, and I did contact him about possibly doing a briefing, and he is nominally interested in that. So I think that I would actually like to talk about this study and other related studies before Congress. And Dallas is, you know, the details aren't worked out, but I have a nominal commitment from him to be a part of that. So we have one of the best people, if not the best, in D.C. on this issue who is willing to bring this before Congress and talk about how important this is.
Great, and we're very happy that he's going to be attending the conference this year. All right, great, Danny. Thanks so much. I want to get a couple of pieces from a couple of other CCL staffers, so I want to hear from Lene and Lawrence in just a little bit, in a real short little bit, and then Steve in Atlanta and Amy on a couple of things. So, Lene, first of all, can you unmute your line?
Hi, Mark. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Okay, so Lene's going to read a note from Jessica Langerman that she sent in with a financial contribution to CCL. Jessica's been one of the most important people in the organization, group leader for one of our chapters in Massachusetts, has written some of the, I think, most important op-eds and letters that we've ever had, ones that I use to show people all the time the kind of organization that we are, and I don't think anybody would be surprised to find out that Jessica is the parent of three foster children, just an extraordinary human being. But someone who we can never get to talk about themselves because they don't like to draw attention to themselves. So, Lene, would you mind reading the note that accompanied Jessica's contribution?
I'm glad to, and I wanted to just say when I asked Jessica permission to share this, she just was a little concerned about it being self-aggrandizing. I said, you know, the reason I'm asking you is because this is so motivating. I think our volunteers would love to hear this.
Great.
A few years ago, as the increasingly frightening scientific data about melting Arctic ice sheets and bubbling fields of methane began to pour in, I decided the wisest, most prudent thing I could do to protect my children's future against the ravages of climate change was to invest in property in Canada. So the last three summers, our family has vacationed in Nova Scotia and Quebec, where I've spent many an afternoon roaming through open houses and peering at the listings in various realtors' windows. My anxiety has been such that I even began to fret that Canada might get smart and close its borders before we could afford to sell our home and invest there. At around the same time, my mother became ill with Alzheimer's. Mom had worked all of her adult life, including during the 10 years of her widowhood, when my brother and I were still young adolescents in school. Those were long, frightening, lean years when our family skirted the boundaries of poverty. Life was not easy for her, but she never, never shirked her duty toward us kids. In 2010 or so, Mom must have realized she was getting sick, as she told my brother and me for the first time that she had managed to save, over the course of her life, a nest egg which she was going to leave to us. God knows what anxiety, self-discipline, and sacrifice those savings must have cost her. We were both astonished and profoundly grateful. When Mom passed away in September, I came into my share of that inheritance. Here was my chance to buy the Canadian property free and clear. But that was also around the time that Peter Joseph gave his great gift to CCL. For the first time, it occurred to me that I could do something similar. After all, what did it mean to buy property in Canada? What exactly was I planning on doing? Giving up on my own country and creating a survivalist bunker in Nova Scotia? What would be next? Machine guns and German shepherds? Maybe, instead of running and protecting only myself, I could choose to stand and fight global warming, using the mightiest weapon of all, my political power. I could take this money that my mom had scrimped and saved all her life and use it to help empower other people the way I have been empowered, by giving almost all of it to CCL. So that is what I am doing. I think Mom, a truly thoughtful, patriotic American, and a lifelong environmentalist, would be proud.
Great. Thank you, Jessica, and Lene, thank you so much for reading this. This is one of the most significant financial contributions CCL's ever gotten. It's a game changer for us. Thank you. Whew. Okay, Steve Vault, tough to follow that, but can you unmute your phone for a second?
Yes, Mark, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. So, Steve, we now have a date for the Pope's encyclical, and could you just give people a quick taste of something that we're going to be doing regarding the media side of that?
Great. So if you all haven't heard from now, the exciting news is that Pope Francis will be releasing his encyclical on Thursday, June 18th, and that's less than a week before we lobby on Capitol Hill. Now, we realize that with the conference coming up, most of you are already spending a lot of time getting meetings, updating bios, and training yourselves to prepare for your time in Washington. So this is a big opportunity, but it's something that you should take on only if you have the capacity to do it or if there is someone in your group you can assign it to. So here are the opportunities. Earlier this week, we sent out a press release template to group leaders. This press release is to inform your local media that volunteers in your area are going to Washington to lobby members of Congress for a solution to climate change. Now, the press release will also tie into the release of the Pope's encyclical, which is why we suggest sending it out the morning of June 18th when the encyclical is released. So let's say you're in Raleigh. The headline on your press release will read, "As Pope releases climate message, Raleigh volunteers head to D.C. to lobby for solutions." Along with the press release, we will also be sending out a media packet that can be pitched to editorial writers on the morning of June 18th. Now, there is a good chance that many papers will weigh in with an editorial about the Pope's encyclical in the next day's editions. So this presents us with an opportunity to generate editorials urging Congress to take up carbon fee and dividends. So if there's someone in your group who is able to take it on, we have the press release about your group going to Washington right after the Pope's encyclical, and we also have the media packet to pitch to editorial writers. Mark, back to you.
Okay, and then, Steve, let me just ask you one more thing. I think that you have someone from the Franciscan Action Network for our July call to really leverage off the Pope's action. Is that correct?
Yes, we do. We have the executive director of the Franciscan Action Network. His first name is Patrick. I don't know his last name, but he is the executive director, and he's been speaking out a lot about the Pope's encyclical, and so he'll have a lot that he can offer us in terms of how we can leverage the Pope's encyclical, the messaging for that, and tools for doing presentations.
Okay, great. And then just so everybody knows, the July call is on the 11th, not on the 4th of July, so we do not, sorry, Canada, but we don't do a call on July 4th, so the July call will be on the 11th. Steve, thank you for that and all the work you put into it. Okay, Amy, can you unmute your phone for a second?
Yes, I can. Here I am.
Okay, good. Let's talk about the conference in just a second. Let me just mention a couple things about Canada before we get to the conference. So today's the last day to support the crowdfunding campaign. You would go to the Canadian website on the right side. It's been remarkably successful at funding some advertisements on the radio and TV, sorry. So if you have contributed to that, thank you. But this is the last day, and if we could raise some more money, it just allows us to do some incredible things. Also, 28 of our Canadians lobbied 25 parliamentarians this week. 23 of those meetings were face-to-face. So, Canada, that is remarkable work. And in addition to a bunch of people being in Ottawa last week, a bunch of Canadians are still coming to the conference in 2 weeks. Amazing. And then also, we wanted to send a big shout-out to Keith and Jean from Clearwater, British Columbia, who've been riding their bikes across Ontario, who now have 28,000 signatures on their fee and dividend petition. Remarkable, remarkable work, Canada. Okay, Amy, so let's just do a quick update on the conference. So, first of all, how many people are registered for the conference?
Mark, we have 784 registered to lobby and a total of 847 that are going to be attending the conference.
Okay, good. And how many appointments do we have so far?
Right now we've got 388 and with just another 100 and something to go. My math's not that good.
Okay, so we're doing, you know, everybody should be doing their last minute of confirming the face-to-faces, et cetera. And then, you know, what you're doing is dealing with the things like 3,200 scheduling decisions have to be made, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good. So for everybody who's never been to D.C., D.C. lobbying is a little bit different than what we do in district, where you can control everything. And because there's 3,200 decisions, a lot of it has to be done electronically. And so the software program we've wrote is heavily biased towards constituents, is heavily biased towards the person who got the appointment. Some people have made requests for exceptions. In some cases, we'll be able to do them. Sometimes we won't. But we'll make sure that we have the best possible effort we can for every member of Congress. And, Amy, you know, so we're pushing out more information than we ever have. How many meeting notes from previous meetings have been sent out to the liaisons to help prepare for the conference?
Mark, the liaisons have received 1,755 meeting minute notes that have been sent out to them electronically.
Okay, so that means from over 1,700 previous meetings that have been had with members of the House and Senate, those have been pushed back so that liaisons can use it to prepare, help prepare their group for the meeting in Washington. Also, every single meeting will have a bio. Most of those have been updated to include current information, so there's an enormous amount of work that has been done. Just so everybody knows, the plan is on the same day the encyclical comes out, June 18th, that we're going to push out your schedule and bios. So everybody, please check all of your email folders, because there'll be 800 emails going out at once. It could go to your spam folder. It could go to your shoulder, your social folder. What we want you to do is to print your bios and schedules before you come to Washington, D.C. And also, if you're a meeting lead, there will be a list of the other people who are in the meeting with you. And if you could all please find a way of connecting with your group before you actually lobby. So maybe you set up a brief call. Maybe you have breakfast with them. Maybe you have dinner with them. Maybe you have lunch with them. But what we want to do is maximize the impact of the three lobby meetings everybody will have on Tuesday by doing as much preparation that we can do in advance before the conference. And, Amy, you know, one thing also that you've been reminding me every day is, as we send last-minute reminders, to please not send the schedulers long reminders, because most of the congressional staffers are reading their mail on phones. So if we can just be brief and to the point, but make sure that particularly this week we finalize those last 160 meetings we need, right?
Right. Thanks, Mark, for that reminder.
Okay.
Yep, I think most of them are looking at all of their emails on their phone.
Okay, excellent. Okay, anything else that you want to report on this month?
Well, Mark, yes. As a matter of fact, when we've had so much focus on the conference, I just want to mention that we actually had a really strong number of meetings with members of Congress and Parliament this month, 31 in the U.S. and 28 in Canada. So we've got 59 reported meetings with Congress and Parliament, which is a real strong figure. Really happy about that.
Fantastic.
And one other thing, Mark, I kind of want to tell you about something that I've been having lots of fun with. We've mentioned it before a little bit. We've all been so busy on the conference, so sometimes it's really nice to have something outside of that, kind of something way out there, a project that I've been working on, and I've been working on it for some time. As you know, I have been trying to get your favorite guy and mine, Jon Stewart, to have you as a guest on The Daily Show to talk to CCL. Well, it helps if you have a book so that you can get interviewed about the book on the show. So we decided to go ahead and self-publish a book. It's called Democracy as It Should Be, How 600 Volunteer Lobbyists Met with 507 Congressional Offices in June of 2014, Influencing the Legislative Process. And that book includes all of CCL members' letters to the editor and op-eds from last June. And it's over 250 pages of all of your op-eds and letters. So thank you all for those letters. And that's on our website. If anybody wants to download it, look under the Action tab and look for Jon Stewart's name and go there, and you'll be able to get a download of the book. It's pretty exciting. Last week, we had a hard copy of the book delivered to The Daily Show's New York offices, and we've also emailed them several times, and actually, they're really nice on the phone. I was able to give my little elevator pitch and everything. We've posted the request on The Daily Show's Facebook page, and Ricky and Steve have posted it to the Citizens Climate Lobby Facebook page, and lots of you all have shared it on your own Facebook page and tweeted about it. So thanks so much for doing that. And lastly, you know, Joseph Robertson told me he actually knows where Jon Stewart lives, where his house is in New Jersey. He's driven by it a few times and has identified, oh, yeah, that's Jon Stewart's house. So we hadn't finished with our pitch to Jon yet, and we're trying to figure out, well, what is this address of his house? But Joe's in Europe for a few weeks, and we were having trouble getting the actual street address. So thanks to the internet and those search engines that, you know, where you can actually map out and see which house is which, Joe figured out the address, and fingers crossed, we sent one more copy of the book to John Stewart's house, and it should arrive on Monday morning. So we are keeping our fingers crossed that we will get on John's radar. And as we've all heard many times before, and I tell Mark all the time, if you don't ask to be interviewed by John Stewart, you'll never get interviewed by John Stewart. So that's what my last little share, Mark.
All right, Amy, way blast. That could be really, really some really fun exposure for the organization. Glad that you took that on. Glad you're having fun with it, particularly when it does get pretty intense when we get close to the conference here. Okay, I want to just talk about lobbying real quick and how it relates to this month's action. So for anybody who was at last year's conference, I think one really poignant moment a lot of us remember is Bob Inglis, early in his talk, asked what he believed to be a really obscure question. And that obscure question was, does anybody know what a border adjustment is? And almost every single hand went up in the room. And that really was a testament of how hard everybody's worked to prepare themselves and how much people practice the laser talks. I think there's two really important components to practicing the laser talks. One is, so that if somebody says to you, what if we don't do something and China does not, that you have something to say. But I think more important than that is the reason we practice laser talks is so that we can listen and pay attention to other people, because that's where we have to be successful, is over there with them. I think it's always good to err on the side that we're not as good a listener as we think we are. I'm going to give you one example of this. So we have been lobbying Duncan Hunter for 6 years, both Duncan Hunter, the current version, and the previous version. So both Duncan Hunter and his dad are Marines. When the older Duncan Hunter retired, younger Duncan Hunter ran for and successfully got elected in his office. We have been meeting with Duncan Hunter, given he and his dad are Marines, about the connection between global warming and national security for years. And obviously that's what you would do. The dad's a Marine, the son's a Marine, of course you would talk to them about the connection between global warming and national security. The most recent meeting we had with Duncan Hunter's office, we asked the aide, what is the most important issue to Duncan Hunter related to global warming? And as we expected the exact answer we got, the answer was agriculture. So what we've been doing is briefing someone about what we think they're interested in rather than finding out what they're actually interested in, and I'm betting that Duncan Hunter is not the only case where we did that. Okay, then I want to just go over what we have. Last month and again this month, we have really, really short laser talks that people can practice. And so it's a really an opening line for a congressional meeting, but also it's a really good answer when people say, I don't think the science is settled. And here's the really short laser talk. We're here to talk about a policy that can grow the economy, add jobs, increase our competitiveness with China, and make our air and water cleaner. Why do I think that's important? I think it's important because the one place where sometimes we get tripped up is on the science issue. And let's just be very, very clear about one thing. Nobody likes to be wrong, and everybody likes to be right. So if we go into a discussion and we have to force them to accept what is actually correct and right about the science, they have to be wrong, and nobody likes that. So what I'm recommending is that you take into account how strong of an urge that is for everybody to have to be right about things and avoid being wrong. So let's say you're in Tennessee and you're meeting with a member of the House or Senate from Tennessee, and they say, well, I don't know why we should do this given the science isn't settled. I always recommend that you start by saying, you know what, we would be happy and we would love to come back here and talk to you about the science, and we could even bring scientists from the University of Tennessee because some of the best scientists in the world are here. And then to simply say, today, we're here to talk about policy that can grow the economy, add jobs, increase our competitiveness with China, and make our air and water cleaner. Why do you always talk about local scientists? Because people trust people that are close to them. People believe that the people in their state are a little better than the, quote, those scientists out there. So I always recommend that you make that piece very specific. Yes, I can come back and I can bring scientists from the University of Georgia. But here, now what you're able to do is move the conversation along with nobody ever having to admit that they were wrong about the science. We're here to talk about a policy that can grow the economy, add jobs, increase our competitiveness with China, and make our air and water cleaner. Okay, so in Canada this month, what we're doing is planning our election strategy, writing group letters, and then also practicing 5 new laser talks. In the U.S., we're asking also people to practice the 11 talks that are in for preparation for the conference. For the Canadians who are coming to the U.S. conference, please make sure you practice those talks also. And then the other thing is to complete all the preparation for lobbying in D.C., make sure any message appointments that haven't been confirmed, get them confirmed, and make sure that also lobby plans, anything that needs to be done, we're doing. Okay, then let's just look at one thing about the conference coming up. So there are three things that are lining up really interestingly. Every day, more and more, you see statements from oil companies talking about the importance of pricing carbon. Two, the Pope's encyclical is coming right up. Three, we're getting very close to a final date on EPA rules. All of those things push towards a market-based solution, and the timing seems very, very interesting on those three. So for everybody who's coming to D.C., we'll see you in 2 weeks. For anybody who's not, we're really happy that you can also participate with the conference by calling in the day before we're on the Hill, encouraging other people to do so, getting the appointments. We want everybody to have an experience of making a major contribution with the conference. Okay, I'm going to mute everybody's line so we can say goodbye. Thank you for all you're doing. See you a bunch in 2 weeks. Talk to everybody else in a month.
Bye.
All guests have been unmuted.
Bye.
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 Bye. Bye.
Thank you from Ground Zero.
Bye.
Well, you too. I mean, whatever.
You're in charge?
What?
We can't come to the phone now. Please leave a message.
For your conspirators and get together in Washington somehow.
Well, whoever the lead, you will. Well, you're not the lead in our meeting. You won't be the lead in any other meeting. And they say it's looking at you.
Oh,
but you'll get.
Thank you.